Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a preview of President Obama's expected executive action on immigration reform due to be announced on Thursday. Angela Maria Kelly, the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, joins us to discuss the extent to which Obama can push the envelope through executive action on immigration reform in the face of an obstructionist Congress whose inactivity on the issue of our broken immigration system has led to the current impasse. We will also assess what reaction and retaliation the Republicans might take amid threats of impeachment and shutting down the government again. Then, with the discovery of the body of a Honduran beauty queen who was due to fly to London to represent Honduras in the Miss World contest, we will examine the roots of violence in this tiny, impoverished country that has the highest homicide rate in the world. Adrienne Pine, a professor of anthropology at American University and a self-described militant medical anthropologist who has worked in Honduras, joins us to discuss the extent to which the U.S. is reaping what it has sowed in Honduras by supporting the 2009 military coup that has turned the country into a narco state. Then finally, we will speak with Alexander Main, the Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose research focuses on U.S. foreign policy in Latin America and the Caribbean and U.S. security and counter-narcotics assistance in Central America. We will discuss the extent to which the decades-long war on drugs has failed to stop Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala from turning into narco states, and how much the recent flight of unaccompanied minors to the United States is the direct result of a lack of security and safety for the citizens of Honduras and El Salvador, who appear to be collateral damage in the failed war on drugs. And joining us now is Angela Maria Kelly, who is Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, a well-known authority on the policy and the politics of immigration. She has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the cost of mass deportation, and the integration trends of America's newcomers. Previously, Angela Kelly served as director of the Immigration Policy Center and prior to that was deputy director at the National Immigration Forum. She's the author of a report released by the Center for American Progress, an economic analysis on the impact of legalizing 11 million immigrants now living and working in the shadows. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Maria Kelly.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And it seems as though the Republicans they've obviously warned the president not to do what he's planning on doing on Thursday, which is announcing immigration reform through executive order. They have warned him, put him on notice, saying that, you know, this is going to poison the well, etc. What's your sense, though, of how they might retaliate? My understanding is, for example, that the Koch brothers front group, Americans for Prosperity, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and others are warning against a government shutdown. So what's your sense of the trench warfare that's going to follow this announcement?
Yeah, I think there's going to be quite the mudslinging and food fight. The Republicans could, because the government is funded under a continuing resolution, as you suggested, they could try to say that they're going to defund the program or try to take away the president's authority to move forward on this kind of program and then dare the president to veto it, and it could lead to a shutdown because we wouldn't expect that the president would sign a piece of legislation that would take away his authority. So that is a consideration, but as you suggested, there are influential Republicans that are seeing that is not a smart way to proceed politically for the Republicans because, A, the blame will likely go to them, B, the rhetoric around this program is one that, if they're too sharp and too harsh, is going to hurt particularly Latino voters' ears. And they're thinking about the 2016 election, which, as we know, is a presidential one, and the Latino voters are particularly influential. So that's, I think, some of the back and forth that the Republican House and Senate leadership are having on whether they use the government being open or closed as a tool, you know, that they hit the president over the head with.
So what do you think the president can and will do with his announcement expected on Thursday? He obviously I think he's going to push the envelope as much as he can, isn't he?
Yeah, I think the president is going to go big and bold, but he's also going to go smart. And the centerpiece of what will probably be a series of announcements that will come, you know, he'll say them all at once tomorrow, but there's going to be different parts to the reform. One is what is called deferred action, and this is something that he's already done for Dreamers, undocumented youth. That program is known as DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and as many people know, it was announced in June of 2012 and has been very successful. There's been, I think, about 600,000 young people who've come forward, and they've gotten work authorization. So I think a central part of what the president will announce tomorrow is another group of people that he is, in his authority, saying are not a priority for removal, and that they may apply on a case-by-case basis for deferred action. What they would receive is very specific. It's work authorization, and it's limited. They would not get residency. They would not get a path to citizenship. And what they have to give is also very specific. They would have to give us biometrics, fingerprints. These people are going to be run through background checks. They're going to have to show that they meet the requirements, however the president designates those. So this is actually, frankly, an opportunity for us to know a little bit better who's here in the country, and at the same time give people a chance to come forward so they can, you know, get on the radar screen and pay taxes.
Well, of course, already Senator Sessions, the Republican senator, is saying that this amounts to executive amnesty, and he's accusing President Obama of surrendering to illegality, and that is not an option. So how's this going to play in the country? Because the country is torn, obviously, and the Democrats certainly didn't show up to vote, and I'm not sure of how much of the contingency the Latinos were responsible for not showing up. I know the young people weren't inspired to vote. Clearly, the Democrats have a problem reaching out to their own people. So what's the narrative going to be in terms of, we know what the narrative from the right is going to be, but what is the narrative from the left going to be?
Well, the ones holding the smoking gun on immigration reform in Congress are the Republicans. In the Senate, there was a bipartisan bill that passed in June of 2013, and it passed with a supermajority. And the House Republican caucus refused time and time again to introduce any piece of legislation except for enforcement bills, and even those didn't move to the floor. So if there's anyone here who has killed the prospects of legislation, it has been House Republicans. Second point, what the president is doing is taking legal action that is within his authority to determine how enforcement resources are going to be used. I think that's smart enforcement. The president is acting completely within the bounds of law, and nothing he is doing precludes Congress from doing its job. So if Congress were to pass a reform bill and actually get the job done, particularly, again, the House Republicans, then the power of executive action is far less. And so the real solution lies on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue with Congress. But we've seen the Republicans time and time again drag their feet and refuse to act. The public wants action. Nobody thinks that the immigration system is functioning. Nobody wants to have 11 million people living in the shadows. And you can have a lot of reasons why you might feel that way that span the political spectrum, but nobody thinks that's a good idea. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? And the president, again, because this is within his authority, is at least taking the first step so people can come forward, they can get in the system, and then we can target resources to people who actually mean to do us harm.
Again, I'm speaking with Angela Maria Kelly, who's the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress. Previously, she served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was Deputy Director at the National Immigration Forum. So in terms of the 11 million people living in the shadows, President Obama's executive action plans that he's announcing on Thursday apparently are going to allow up to 5 million unauthorized immigrants to stay in the United States and obtain work permits. So what happens to the other 6 million?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we know the final numbers yet, but there will be a substantial portion of the undocumented that won't be eligible for this program, and they will still be subject to deportation. People who come in the future will be subject to deportation. People who commit serious crimes, even if they meet the criteria the president announces tomorrow, will be subject to deportation. So sadly, because our laws are so dysfunctional, there will still be a lot for ICE agents, that's DHS enforcement agents, to do.
So in terms of on the Republican side, what's your understanding of where they stand in terms of being torn between those on the more moderate side of the Republican Party who recognize the demographic realities of Latino voters in the future and don't want them to, you know, alienate them in such a flagrant way as has been the case up until now? And then on the other side, you do have clearly, people who are, I hesitate to use the word racist, but they're certainly, xenophobic in their outlook. We saw that terrible manifestations of protests against buses full of unaccompanied minors, children on the border. That was just despicable behavior. So there's a kind of a rather poisonous attitude amongst a lot of Americans towards people less fortunate than they who lived, particularly in Central America.
Yeah, I think it's a rotten time to be a Republican that wants to one day get in the White House. And there are a lot of Republicans that are sitting in states that are up for re-election in 2016 that the president won, and that I think are going to be hard for many Republicans to keep. So from a political perspective, I think you're right. They're drinking a slow poison by alienating the fastest growing demographic of new voters. So my advice to them would be that they work to find a solution and that they deal sensibly with the 11 million. This president hasn't been easy on folks who are here without papers. He's deported more people than any previous president has. And so I think that probably, Exhibit A of how there could be good policy in this arena was a Senate bill that, as I said, was passed bipartisan with a supermajority, four Republicans, four Democrats worked together. And that seems to have just been, forgotten on the House side, again, particularly by the Republicans, because you have the Democrats quite united and willing to pass a piece of legislation. So I think their political futures are really going to be on the line. The heat's going to turn up on them as soon as the details of the announcement become public and we start seeing the program work. There will be a lot of folks looking to the Republican and Democratic hopefuls for the White House saying, what would you do? What would you do if you were sitting in the Oval Office when this expires in 2 or 3 years? And so it's going to be a real moment of reckoning about where they stand.
Well, that would seem to be, in general, the challenge that the Republicans face, that they've been obstructionist continually in their opposition. But now that they have a majority in the Senate and increase their majority in the House and want the presidency, at some point one would think they have to start offering some kind of positive plans and programs as opposed to saying no and being rejectionists.
Yes. Well, I doubt that they're going to call me for advice, but that's certainly what I would tell them. And they've got a playbook that, more than a dozen Republican senators, including Lindsey Graham from very red state South Carolina, that they passed into law. So I don't think it's a secret how we solve a broken immigration system. The House Republicans have failed to act on it, and the president is taking small steps, but they're important steps in the right direction.
So in terms of the more apocalyptic response that has been suggested, and there's certainly a very active Tea Party caucus still within the Republican Party, and I think there was a change in this election. There's some of the punditry have said, oh, well, the Republicans have learned their lessons from putting up extremist candidates, but perhaps they've just put up the same kind of candidates but just told them not to say stupid things. So that, frankly, is my analysis of the new crop in the Congress. So it seems at some point or other, all of this talk about shutting down the government is not going to go away. And there's also another argument that's out there, and that is impeachment. So what's your sense of whether those two things could rear their ugly heads?
So, I mean, it's so ludicrous, right, to impeach the president for acting within his authority and trying to solve a problem and do better enforcement. But the Republican Party has acted in all kinds of ways that have not been particularly strategic. So it's possible, but that they'll rattle that saber. But I don't know that they're going to get very far with it. In order for anything to still pass, and again to the question about whether you shut down the government or you try to pass a law that takes away his authority, all that, you still need 60 votes in the Senate, and they're not 60 Republicans. So I think it's going to be hard for them to do much beyond Kabuki theater, which is going to hurt them in the 2016 election.
Well, Angela Maria Kelly, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Angela Maria Kelly, who's Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress. She's a well-known authority on the policy and the politics of immigration and has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the cost of mass deportation, and the integration trends of America's newcomers. Previously, Angela Kelly served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center and prior to that was Deputy Director at the National Immigration Forum. She's the author of a report released by the Center for American Progress, an economic analysis on the impact of legalizing 11 million immigrants now living and working in the shadows. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the death of the Honduran beauty queen in the country that has the highest homicide rate in the world.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line. De cabeza, sombrita de reflejo, dame algo tierno, me como tu amor y cago en
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adrienne Pine, who is a professor of anthropology at American University, a self-described militant medical anthropologist. Adrienne Pine has worked in Honduras, Mexico, Korea, and the United States and Egypt. In her book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras, she argues that the symbolic violence resulting from Hondurans' embodied obsession with certain forms of real violence is a necessary condition for the acceptance of violent forms of modernity and capitalism. Dr. Pine has worked both outside and inside the academy to effect a more just world, and prior to and following the June 2009 military coup in Honduras, she has collaborated with numerous organizations and individuals to bring international attention to the Honduran struggle to halt state violence in its multiple forms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adrienne Pine.
Thank you for having me.
And the fact that the Honduran beauty queen and her sister, who disappeared recently, the bodies were just found, two men have been arrested. This has sort of highlighted the fact that Honduras is one of the most violent countries in the world, is it not? It has the highest murder rate, at least by some statistics, in the world, or perhaps in the hemisphere. What's your understanding?
Yes, in fact, it has had the highest murder rate in the world for a country that's not officially at war since 2010. And that's according to the UN homicide statistics. Honduras is a place that I think at this point can unproblematically be described as a narco state, and where impunity is the rule of the land. So there's an incredible amount of violence that comes directly from the state, whether those state forces are police, military, or military police. And that also, of course, has ended up correlating with rampant sort of everyday violence. Because there's such impunity, it's very rare, unless it's a case like this, where it's very high profile and, you know, there's a sort of public outcry above and beyond the dozens of people who are killed on a daily and weekly basis. Unless it's a case like this, there's really never any justice to be had. So it's a violence that since the 2009 military coup that overthrew the elected president José Manuel Zelaya Rosales has just increased and skyrocketed to the state that it's in today.
So the fact that the boyfriend of the beauty queen apparently was slighted by the fact that she danced with some other fellow, at least that's the reports one gets. You're suggesting that kind of violence is informed by a larger form of violence?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think there are a lot of different categories of homicides that people create, and they're legitimate. For example, there's a lot of discussion about femicide and feminicide, and this would fall in that category if indeed it's the case that this had to do with a jealous boyfriend or lover. And there is impunity for this kind of violence, and it's tied to a whole structure of patriarchal and domestic violence that exists in Honduras as elsewhere. But that can't be separated from impunity. After the 2009 coup, crimes against crimes of passion, as they're called, these femicides, went up, and part of that was because the people who carried out the coup were backed up by some of the most right-wing televangelists and the right wing of the Catholic Church, which has both of which have been very harmful to women's rights and to the idea that women should deserve protection against boyfriends and husbands who abuse them. And so these kinds of gendered crimes are certainly tied in to the larger structures of violence and impunity in the country.
So why did the U.S. then support this unholy trinity of right-wing Catholics, narco-terrorists, and I take it reactionary oligarchs?
Well, I think that's really the key question, and there's a pretty simple answer, and I think it's because the U.S. sees it as militarily and economically benefiting the country to not have to ensure that Hondurans don't have a say in their own sovereignty or their own democracy. Honduras represents the base of operations, the biggest military base of operations for the United States and the entire region, especially since other countries like Ecuador have been rejecting the renewals on U.S. military base contracts. And so Honduras has gained increasing importance. It's where the wars of the 80s were staged in neighboring countries, in Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua. And it's a very important place strategically for the United States military empire, as it were. But additionally, the coup itself was carried out in large part, in order to remove the sort of citizen blocks against exploiting the land and the water and the air to the absolute maximum. So where people had collective rights to land, those are now being destroyed by U.S. and other foreign corporations who are coming in with the full support of the post-coup government. And there's never been any change in the coup administration, really. There have been a couple elections, but they've put into place people who supported the coup in large part through fraud. So what has happened is it was a coup that was in favor of not just Honduran oligarchs, but of U.S. corporations, of Canadian corporations, of mining corporations, of tourist corporations, who wanted to take advantage of some of the really good land and resources that Honduras has. And that's been the effect, and it's meant that Hondurans themselves are living in greater insecurity than ever before. In addition to the violence, they're having their lands taken away, they're having their means of survival taken away, and all of that combined is why they are fleeing in such large numbers to the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Adrienne Pine, who's a professor of anthropology at American University, a self-described militant medical anthropologist. Adrienne Pine has worked in Honduras and Mexico, and in her book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, On Violence and Survival in Honduras, she argues that the symbolic violence resulting from Hondurans' embodied obsession with certain forms of real violence is a necessary condition for the acceptance of violent forms of modernity and capitalism. So, given that I've just read your bio in that context, explain that your thesis there in terms of cultural insight into Honduran violence.
Sure. What I found in the years leading up to the coup, because my book was published in 2008, 1 year before the coup happened, was that increasingly policies that were imported from Rudy Giuliani's New York, zero tolerance or strong fist policies, which were really, you know, cracking down on crime and criminalizing poverty, and similarly to the way that they did in New York, except for in Central America, there was already an environment of impunity that meant that what ended up happening was that there was, in effect, a reactivation of death squads of the 1980s, but instead of being carried out against suspected communists, which was the case in the 1980s, people who were labeled as gang members or as delinquents simply by identification, not by having committed a crime, but by having tattoos or things like that. It was open season on them. So undercover cops were killing them, and there was complete impunity for it, and it was justified by this policy of zero tolerance. And there were thousands of young men in particular who were killed during this period of, in the early 2000s. And what I found to my surprise was that the people whose own children were being shot at by these death squads, despite that violence and the insecurity that they lived as a result of these state policies, were in support of those policies. They had this idea that the violence against them was coming not from neoliberal policies of privatization and that were taking away their infrastructure, that were taking away their salaries and their rights to have good jobs, et cetera, but rather were coming from gang members themselves, who, viewed from another perspective, were, you know, many gang members in Honduras, at least in the early 2000s, were young kids who had no real other social network, who didn't have employment opportunities. And, you know, it was for many of them, it was kind of like a social club. I don't mean to make light at all of the violence that gangs did carry out, but not all gang members were killing people at that time. Nonetheless, anybody who was a young poor man was suspected of being a gang member, and that justified their murder. So instead of looking at structural causes of violence, instead of looking at the United States economic and military policies in Honduras, Honduran poor people turned their gaze upon each other, and they felt unsafe because they felt like they themselves were making themselves unsafe. And it was a really effective strategy for the wealthy to use, and it's something that they reinforced through the media, through what I called in my work, I've called it death porn. If you look at Honduran newspapers, what you'll see every single day is horrendous pictures of dead bodies, of, you know, people decapitated, of bodies in the water, and it's the same with a television as well. And so there's this this sort of hammering away at people's sense of self and the sense of the worth of a life, I think, that makes people feel very, very vulnerable and very quick to jump to a security solution rather than a building democracy solution. And what really highlighted that for me after the coup was that there was this moment when everybody seemed to realize that it had all been a lie. There were a lot of sayings where people said things like, the masks have come off. We finally realized that it's not ourselves who are causing this violence. That is, it's the wealthy, it's the foreign corporations, and there was a real movement for 2 years, the National People's Resistance Front, and there was a really different way that people looked at it. But now, as violence has increase to these completely unthinkable levels, there seems to be a retreat back into this politics of terror and security that is the norm again today.
So it sounds like the United States government, if they supported this coup, which they appear to have done, against Zelaya, and my understanding was that they were trying to paint him as another Chavez, and that was why they sided with the reactionaries. But, of course, the results, as you've described them, of the conditions today are such that you have unaccompanied minors fleeing from Honduras to the United States. There is this thing called the war on drugs. If you have a narco state, that flies in the face of the logic of the war on drugs. So it makes me wonder, which side of the U.S. government is working. The Pentagon talks about the possibility of Mexico becoming a failed state and what a catastrophe that would be. And we've just seen enormous outrage in Mexico over the disappearance of the 43 students. And that's still enraging Mexican citizens who, by the way, feel the word that you've used, the impunity, that there's no justice and there's impunity for, the narcos and their political agents. So this seems to suggest to me, Adrian Pine, a great deal of confusion, policy confusion, if that's the best way to describe it, on the part of the U.S. government.
Well, I think confusion is a generous way of putting it, because indeed what our U.S. government is trying to paint is a picture of failed states, as you say. But I think that's a deceitful language. I think narco state is more appropriate, and indeed the people in Mexico who have risen up so impressively over the Ayotzinapa killings are calling the state out as a narco state, and they're actually saying that there's intentionality here, that it's not a mistake, that it's not just a failure that the state ended up like it is. It's actually the result of the drug war. It's the result of specific policies and of privileging an agenda of privatization over an agenda of sovereignty and democracy. And in Honduras, the drug war, it is, in fact, absurd from a perspective of, if the aim of the drug war were really to end the drug trade, then it would be absurd that the United States is partnering with the military, which historically has been the most important player in drug trade in Honduras, and that it's, only giving more money to this drug war when, in fact, it has been behind so much of the violence over the past 6 years in particular. So it would be absurd if the drug war were really about ending the drug trade. But in my sense, it's not about that at all. It's about making territories unlivable and ungovernable so that the drug trade and corporations, extractive corporations in particular, can have free reign.
So it's obvious that nobody looks at the absurdity of the war on drugs in terms of culpability, because the United States is the market. You wouldn't have narco states in Honduras, Mexico, and Guatemala but for the fact that the market for the narcotics is here in the United States. So, again, forgive my confusion, but I'm trying to figure out here why our government policy effectively has created a symbiotic relationship with the drug trade through the war on drugs. At the same time, nobody is dealing with why it is that Americans take drugs and why it is that we are not holding ourselves as a country responsible for the mayhem that we're creating south of the border.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of Latin American presidents on the right and on the left have brought this point up, that that if we really want to deal with drug use, then we need to decriminalize it and regulate it here in the United States and stop criminalizing poor people who may or may not be involved in the drug trade and partnering with the wealthy people who certainly are in the drug trade throughout the Americas. And of course, drugs are devastating in many people's lives, and if we don't have a policy of where people are able to deal with drug addiction without being criminalized, then we're repeating the same sort of violent criminalization of the poor that we have carried out, we being, you know, Rudolph Giuliani, the U.S. government has helped to export to Central American countries, not just Honduras, but Guatemala and El Salvador, which are suffering violence in similar ways.
Well, do you think then that the murder of this young Honduran beauty queen and her sister, and somewhat poignantly and ironically, of course, this young woman who was supposed to attend the Miss World contest in London, wanted to be a diplomat? I mean, what is the chance of this country that's battered by violence and crime with an establishment of criminality, both, as you say, the church, the oligarchs, the military? It's become a narco state. It was propelled in that direction by the U.S. in the recent coup of 2009, where they supported the very people who have created this narco state. It seems like all the decks stacked against anything good coming out of this situation. But of course, you know, usually it's incidents like this that at least focus people's attention. So what can we expect from the idea that the spotlight is now on Honduras because of the murder of this beauty queen?
Well, it's of course tragic, and as you mentioned, tragically ironic that this young woman with such a promising future had her life cut short in this horrendous way. And I hope that it can highlight the fact that there is this intense level of impunity in Honduras, and that it's a result not of bad culture, but of bad policies, of bad decisions, and of many of those are bad decisions made by the United States. And if we were to stop funding the Honduran military, if we were to stop sending all of that military and police aid through CARSI, the Central American Regional Security Initiative, and if we were to uphold our own laws about human rights protections conditioning our aid, then we could make a huge difference from the United States in Honduras. This kind of impunity wouldn't be able to survive without our support, and I think that's the message that many people in Honduras and the whole solidarity movement with Honduras here in the United States has been steadfastly sending to Congress. And in many cases, you know, we've had a number of congressional letters with up to over 100 signatories calling for an end to military and police aid to Honduras. That's what needs to happen for this violence to begin to abate and for Hondurans to begin to be able to have some sort of functioning democracy.
But just in closing, you surely can't blame the parents of children in Honduras wanting to get them out of this place. And the same is true next door in El Salvador. I mean, at what point, and in Mexico, at what point do Americans stop demonizing immigrants fleeing and recognize their direct culpability in helping create conditions in these countries where people simply can't live a stable and secure life?
Absolutely. I mean, it forces us to take a hard look at ourselves as a country, as citizens, and recognize that, you know, where we're throwing the blame to parents who are allowing their children to migrate to save their lives, that we actually played a role in making their lives so vulnerable. And, you know, if we believe in our democracy at all, we need to start demanding our politicians to act differently.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Adrienne Pine.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Adrienne Pine, who's a professor of anthropology at American University, a self-described militant medical anthropologist. Adrienne Pine has worked in Honduras and Mexico, and in her book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras, she argues that the symbolic violence resulting from Hondurans' embodied obsession with certain forms of real violence is a necessary condition for the acceptance of violent forms of modernity and capitalism. Dr. Pine has worked both outside and inside the academy Academy to effect a more just world. And prior to and following the June 2009 military coup in Honduras, she has collaborated with numerous organizations and individuals to bring international attention to the Honduran struggle to halt state violence in its multiple forms. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how much the war on drugs has turned Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico into narco states.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty. Dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms. And if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands for workers' misconduct. I got the power to shoot a copper and not get charged. And it would be sad to see your family in front of a firing squad. So the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Main, who's a Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who focuses on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America and the Caribbean. His area of expertise includes Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy in Central America, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Honduras. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Main.
Hello, thank you.
And Alexander, there's obviously a lot of focus now on Honduras because of the disappearance over a week ago of a Honduran beauty queen, a 19-year-old, along with her sister. They were just found, their bodies were just found, literally, at the time when this young woman was supposed to fly to London to represent Honduras in the Miss World contest. This highlights the fact that Honduras, of course, has the highest murder rate in the world, according to the United Nations. What's your explanation, since you know the country and study it, for this grim statistic?
Well, yes, it's a very grim statistic, but as you say, it's a statistic, and it's an all-too-familiar statistic in the case of Honduras, which has a homicide rate of something like 93 per 100,000. And just to give you sort of a means of comparison, in the U.S., the rate hovers between 2 and 3 per 100,000. So it's, you know, essentially the homicide rate of a war zone at the moment. And in fact, that's how it's often referred to, certainly by human rights defenders in the area. And in the case of the tragic murder of this beauty queen and her sister, and they were both murdered on the same night, something exceptional occurred, which I think is worth highlighting, which is that the police were very quick to act and have apparently found the perpetrator, who appears to have been the husband of the sister of the beauty queen, and who may have committed the murder for reasons of jealousy. It's not altogether clear, but at any rate, they have the murder weapon, they have the vehicle that the bodies were transported in, and so on and so forth. Extremely quick work. It's hard to say whether this evidence that's been produced is accurate, but certainly what we can see is that the security forces and the judicial authorities have been extremely diligent in this case, and that is very exceptional. And I think that's something that human rights defenders in the country have been quick to remind people of, which is that this one case, obviously a high-profile case, Miss Honduras being killed, something was done about it, and someone may end up going to court, may end up going to jail for it. But in the vast majority of murders like this that occur every day in Honduras, and indeed it's an everyday occurrence, I think you have a statistic of something like 40 women alone that are killed each month. there is complete impunity around these cases. And both the police and judicial authorities completely failed to act. And an additional thing is that often there is police and military complicity in a lot of killings that occur. There are many, many extrajudicial killings that occur of young people on a daily or weekly basis, particularly in Tegucigalpa and in San Pedro Sula, which is the most violent city in the world in northern Honduras. And these young people, often teenagers, suspected of being in gangs, but no one's ever certain, they are killed by dozens in the middle of the night every month, and there is absolutely no investigation of these murders, any sort of prosecution. And it's widely believed that the security forces themselves are in, you know, armed death squads and are perpetrating these killings. So that sort of gives you an idea of what everyday life is, certainly for a lot of young people in Honduras, and particularly those who are in the poorest communities of Honduras.
And this, of course, must be connected with the flight of unaccompanied minors heading north. I take it parents living under these conditions, the only way that they can protect their children is to get them out of this violent environment.
Well, absolutely. And certainly many of the children who fled north recently, and of course there was a big wave that occurred towards the beginning of the year and lasted until June, July, until you started to see a major crackdown at the border between Guatemala and Mexico, so carried out by both Mexican and Guatemalan security forces, a big crackdown on migration at that level. But the masses of children who fled north, many of them have parents already in the United States, who many of them are actually here. Many of them are undocumented, obviously, but many of them are here with temporary protective status, which they've had because of the natural disasters that have occurred in Honduras and in El Salvador. And, you know, they have the legal right to be in the U.S., and yet there is no legal mechanism for them to bring their children over except through these clandestine means. So there is no legal way for them to pursue that. And so the children, because of the level of violence and because of the fear that the parents have that their children will be the next target, and indeed, as I said, many of the targets are young people and teenagers, you know, they are prepared to do anything to get them over. And that means traveling on the train called La Bestia in Mexico, being extorted right and left by people in the cartels, but also corrupt officials all along the way, and many disappearing, thousands and thousands, never making it to the border with the U.S. There's a very, very high rate of disappearances and also a very high rate of rapes and other forms of abuse against these minors traveling north. So these are the sort of conditions that they have to face, and that often that they're prepared to face because the level of violence is so intolerable in their communities of origin in Honduras. And again, I think this is extended to other countries, certainly El Salvador and Guatemala in the same region.
Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Main, who's the Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose focus is on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America and the Caribbean. His area of expertise includes Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy in Central America, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Honduras. So everything you've told us so far, Alexander Main, surely this has something to do, if not a lot to do, with the decades-long war on drugs that has failed to stop Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala from turning into narco states. So to what extent are we responsible for Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras becoming narco states, not to mention El Salvador, where the gang violence is rampant? And, of course, these gangs that intimidate the El Salvadorans originated, two of the main ones originated here in Los Angeles, for God's sake. So I find it impossible to extricate the United States from these conditions, yet somehow we don't want to take responsibility for them.
Well, no, that's absolutely right. And in terms of U.S. responsibility for the drug war and its impact on human rights and the level of violence in these countries, the U.S. is pretty much entirely responsible. First of all, because drugs simply transit through these countries. Very little, comparatively speaking, is actually consumed in the countries. Almost all of it goes to consumers in the U.S., and of course the U.S. is the biggest consumer of illegal drugs in the world. And it's drugs that are simply flowing through this area in order to get from Colombia, mostly, certainly in the case of cocaine, to the United States. But these countries that are in the drug trafficking corridor aren't all affected equally. And I think there's some important distinctions, actually, that are worth highlighting, where you have the three countries of the Northern Triangle of Central America that we've mentioned, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, that have been affected by very, very high levels of violence and also are facing dire economic conditions. And then you have a country like Nicaragua, which sits right next to them and which is squarely in the middle of this drug trafficking corridor as well, which is facing very hard economic conditions as well, and yet you're not seeing the same flight of people towards the north. They're not the same migration levels by any means. I mean, they're a tiny blip in terms of the statistics of migrants fleeing Central America to go to the U.S. And that has something to do with the fact that Nicaragua doesn't have the violence that these other countries have. And the important difference, I think, lies in the fact that you have more functional law enforcement institutions, less corrupt and more functional. The police community model in Nicaragua is widely recognized to be highly effective, and they don't have the same sort of gang violence problem and so on. Nicaragua is free of a lot of these institutional problems, these weak institutions and corrupt institutions that these other countries have, and isn't receiving the sort of security assistance that is going to these other countries. And so that's the other part of the U.S.'s responsibility here, which is that in order to deal with this drug trafficking, they have been promoting methods of law enforcement that are very heavy-handed and that are often militarized. Certainly in Guatemala and Honduras, we're seeing a great deal of militarization of the drug interdiction efforts that are taking place, and that goes far beyond the drug interdiction efforts. That goes to just basic policing. The military is in the streets in these countries, and they've created new hybrid military police forces in the last few years. They've also done so in Mexico. And everything indicates that these new developments that are completely backed by the U.S., and U.S. funding towards these countries has gone up a huge amount. It's really gone up something like between 8 and 10 times over the last 10 years or so, that this is simply contributing to the empowerment and technical capacity to kill and to repress of these security forces. And again, they are very involved, very complicit in a great deal of the violence taking place in these countries. and with total impunity. You have very weak and corrupt judicial authorities that simply do not seek to apprehend those responsible for most of the killings, particularly when security forces appear to be involved, except in cases like that of Miss Honduras. When they're very high-profile cases, they'll act, but in the vast majority of cases, absolutely nothing is done, which only allows, it really gives a blank check to these security forces to continue killing with impunity.
But Alexander Main, when you mentioned the fact that Nicaragua doesn't have the narco violence that its neighbors have, it's also pretty clear that Costa Rica, right next door as well, does not have the same narco violence. And in fact, it doesn't have a military. And I suspect that might well be a better model than militarizing the problems, which the U.S. has done through the assistance to these militaries. So what's your sense then of whether this will ever stop? I mean, this war on drugs has become a massive gravy train for a vast bureaucracy. They have a kind of symbiotic relationship with the problem. Nobody here in the United States wants to accept our cultural and societal responsibility for consuming drugs, which is where all the money comes from that corrupts and destroys these countries. And yet here we are upset that all of the collateral damage, these poor people who can't live in these countries because there's no security and safety for them and their children, are fleeing north, facing, as you pointed out, enormous dangers on the way. We're getting it coming and going, but somehow we don't seem to want to look at, not so much the root causes of violence, but our responsibility.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the first thing is building awareness of that responsibility in the country. I think when there was this crisis at the border with this massive wave of child migrants at the beginning of the summer, it led to a debate that was, often just the Republicans blaming the Democrats for being too weak on border security and on immigration enforcement. But occasionally, there were some openings here and there where some of the root causes were addressed. And the people who are leaving the Northern Triangle today and fleeing towards the North can be rightly described as refugees. In fact, the UN High Commission on Refugees considers that an apt term to qualify them. That needs to be understood, that U.S. policy is a key part of this. And so there needs to be a debate around U.S. security policy and also, of course, a debate on how the U.S. Is dealing with its own drug problem.
Well, Alexander Main, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Main, who's the Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, whose focus is on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America and the Caribbean. His area of expertise includes Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy in Central America, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Honduras. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.